Welcome back. You're listening to On the Origins of Spirits, it's Sydney, and this is the second episode, Behind the Juniper Berries, Gin Edition. If you're ever going to put alcohol in the spotlight of its effects on the culture and society, yesterday, today, and tomorrow. We're going to go beyond that initial bottle-popping surface understanding of alcohol to instead explore its history, creation, and culture. All topics that I feel are often neglected while we sip them at the barstool. Today we're going to focus on the intoxicating history of gin and what's come from it today. As I've previously mentioned before in the first episode, I'm a bartender and I'm also a student, so I've had the ability to simultaneously observe and learn while working. On slow days at the bar, when I stare at the shelves of alcohol, learning them by not only name but also ABV, gin has always grabbed my attention with its bright colors and unique label designs. So to begin, the word gin is derived from the French word genever and the Dutch word genever. Excuse my pronunciations, but both mean juniper either way. Juniper berries provide the predominant flavors in gin, and juniper communis, again, excuse my pronunciation, is Latin for the word common juniper. It's a female seed cone that's not technically a berry, but it has a berry-like appearance with this fleshy exterior, and it's responsible for gin's distinctive flavor, which is described by many as being Christmas tree-like. A little background on the berries themselves without actually showing you a picture. Juniper berries look a lot like blueberries. They can be used fresh or dried, but it has been found that their flavor is at its strongest immediately after they are harvested, and then declines in potency through drying and storing. Considered by many to be too bitter to eat, it's often used as a spice. So juniper berries are used in Europe to add a specific clean and sharp flavor to their meat dishes. The spice is made from the berries that are harvested during the most dark and mature stage, while gin, on the other hand, is made from the fully grown green juniper berries right before they turn their purplish blue. So as a little history, during the Black Death and during the 11th century, Italian monks had flavored distilled spirits with juniper berries in an effort to create a remedy to the plague, though understandably it was vastly ineffective. But if it was consumed in large enough quantities, as the drunkenness effects of alcohol took place, it likely did help lessen the perception of the symptoms that were associated with the illness. But beyond this, as the science of distillation advanced into the Renaissance period, juniper was recognized for its scent, flavor, and believed medicinal purposes. Fast forward a little bit, gin likely traces its origins to liquors that were produced back in the Middle Ages. There's a few references to the spirit-flavored genever that was produced in a 13th century Flemish manuscript, but by the 1600s, the Dutch were producing gin by the liters. There were hundreds of distilleries in the city of Amsterdam, and Holland is thought to be the birthplace that was credited with gin's creation, which is during the 16th century. A Dutch physician by the name of Francis Sylvius also used juniper berry oil in 1550 as a medicinal purpose. It was then added to distilled spirits, mixed with botanicals, and the demand for it skyrocketed. It gave a way for the opening of small distilleries and non-medicinal versions of gin. But by 1663, there had been approximately 400 different Dutch and Flemish distillers in Amsterdam alone. They had polarized the redistillation of spirits and wines with juniper berries, coriander, anise, and other plants that were used to treat medical problems. It didn't take long for this lovely liquor to hop across the English Channel, though, and it was in a big way. In the latter half of the 17th century and the early years of the 18th century, gin had gained so much popularity in England that it was cementing the association it still enjoys with that nation. Gin became instantly popular when King William III came across the throne in 1689, and he had immediately declared it as the official drink of the court. He had created a series of statutes that encouraged the distillation of gin in England, and the laws were so loose that people could distill it by simply posting a notice outside their house and waiting for approval. And I believe that was within 10 days of approval. At one point, employers were actually using gin to pay their workers. It was a form of currency at one point. And before long, there was more gin in England than beer, wine, and any other spirits. Much like Amsterdam, England was also becoming very popular, and London specifically was a popular place for distilling. And by 1720, experts have estimated that as many as a quarter of the households in London were producing their own gin. The period in the storied city's history became known as the gin craze. It was an era that was so awesome that Parliament had to pass no fewer than 5 major legislative acts over the course of 20 to 22 years in an attempt to rein in the population's consumption of gin. Allegedly, obviously, this all led to overconsumption, and by the 1730s, a law had been passed to raise the taxes of gin production so that people were drinking less, producing less. This has led to riots, and eventually a new act was passed to make distiller's tax more similar to those already imposed on beer and alehouses at the time. So after the gin craze in England, it wasn't long before it made it to America, or what we had still called the colonies at the time. Even though they had gained their independence from Britain, the spirit still grew in popularity here. By the 19th century, gin's popularity in England had slowly plateaued, but the history of gin in America was just beginning. A major factor increased popularity was the development of new and unique styles of gin. So there's about four or five different types. The first one that had come across in America was known as Old Tom Gin, which was softer and sweeter. It was first developed in England in the 18th century and enjoyed its popularity in America until the early 20th century. A new technology known as column still distillation occurred in the mid-19th century, and this allowed for the production of a pure base spirit to what we now know as London Dry Gin, or simply a dry gin. So gin really was a fan favorite in the United States until around 1967, when vodka, as we'd previously talked about in the last episode, took over as America's favorite spirit. It continued to decline throughout the century as vodka and rum and other types of alcohol started to take over throughout the United States, and unfortunately today, gin only holds a small share of alcohol sales in the United States, but as there's a resurgence in craft cocktails and craft gin distilleries, there's hope that it can make a comeback. And specifically speaking, the bar that I work at is honed in on craft cocktails in a wine bar. So we really use most of our cocktails, I'd say 75% use gins, and whether it's a London Dry or a botanical gin, we have a lavender martini that's amazing, but it's very focused on the craft cocktail side of alcohol. And I think that's what I kind of want to lead into with the rest of this episode, is what we're missing when we simply make just a vodka cranberry, just a gin and tonic. We're really missing out on that history and the comeback that we could potentially be focused on. So a little fun fact and a little background on American history and pop culture with gin. The author F. Scott Fitzgerald allegedly had a taste for the gin Ricky, and it was rumored that gin was his spirit of choice because the smell didn't linger on his breath. And he loved the cocktail so much that he featured it in The Great Gatsby. And when Daisy asked Tom to make us a cold drink during an exceptionally hot day, the husband preceedingly poured four gin Rickies. And basically a gin Ricky is, if you were wondering, the recipe is 50 milliliters of gin, one lime halved, and then soda water. And you fill a highball glass with ice, and you add the gin, and then you juice the lime halves into the glass and drop in the juice lime shells. You top with soda water. I thought that was a little interesting side fact for the episode. So now that I just mentioned a type of gin, a dry gin means that there are no added artificial flavors or sweeteners. It's all natural from different botanicals. Some London dries also steep fresh citrus peels before distillation that give them a little bit of a twist, and it makes a big difference in a martini. There's also Plymouth gin, which is a lighter, more citrus-forward style that originated in the port of Plymouth on the English Channel. Today, there's only one distiller that has the right to produce it, and it's Plymouth Coates & Company. There's also Old Tom gin, which is most famously included in the Tom Collins cocktail, and it's a sweeter version that includes simple syrup or sometimes licorice, also put in before distillation. The next one is New Western Dry Gin, which is a modern style with a less dominant flavor of juniper, and instead it supports botanicals and flavors that really just are at the center stage of flavor. So gin can be produced in two different ways. It can be distilled or redistilled. Distilled is, it starts from a lower ABV of fermented alcohol, which can be derived from grains, sugar beets, potatoes, sugar cane, or grapes, much like vodka. And redistilled gin already has a distilled spirit, which is usually a neutral grain as the base. And then the juniper and botanicals are infused into the spirit using one of two methods. The first way, it can be steeped or boiled directly into the base of the alcohol, or it can be suspended above the liquor and impart their flavor aromas via vapor infusion, which is pretty interesting. So I had the opportunity to interview Professor Stephen Ulbricht Gin Carilla again. And if you didn't catch the last episode, he's a professor at the University of Massachusetts, where he teaches a course on the folklore of alcohol. The first question I asked him was, how do you think gin relates to contemporary culture?
What gin has currently become is in many ways a metaphor for the, maybe the instant gratification of the internet age, right? Ask your grandparents what gin was, and they may literally say beef eater, right? There was a taste of gin that was gin, that was the simple taste of gin, even for me, right? Because I kind of enjoyed gin, early on in my life. But it was a taste of juniper drink, right? And it was you probably a dry London style juniper drink. That was the taste of gin. And today, that is not the taste of gin. Today, you can have gin basically be whatever flavor you want it to be. There is always going to be juniper, and there's probably going to be anise and angelica and a couple of other things that tend to be in everyone. But in the past 20 years, the gin revolution, right? The gin renaissance, as it's often called, means that virtually any flavor, any taste can be used. And so, when my dad would go to the bars, say in the 1970s, there'd be maybe two bottles of gin up on the wall, and they basically tasted the same. You go now to a bar, and there may be 20, 30 different types of bottles of gin, and they don't have the same taste. There'll be a Hendrick's that tastes like cucumber. There'll be a London Dry. There'll be, probably a Plymouth Dry. There's going to be what we now think of, and this is only 20, the past 20 years, the rise of American gins, American dry gins, sometimes they're called New Western gins, and they barely have a taste of juniper. Lots of other botanical flavors, very little flavor of juniper for there. So another way of thinking about contemporary culture and gins and contemporary cultures, it perfectly matches the if we can think of the culture of both the connoisseur. We can think of the culture, the kind of capitalist culture that demands, right, immediate gratification and variety, right? I mean, then that is certainly being seen in what gin is now. I could make the case that, gin and vodka are vying, to be the drink that symbolizes the immediacy of the moments, the immediacies of different tastes and different pleasures. I want this taste now. I want something different. And so what was, again, kind of established flavor profile and established drink profile has gone, I'm saying gone off the rails, not that it's a bad thing. I'd much rather have variation. I think it's very interesting. It's fascinating. It speaks to different styles. Those different styles speak to different, generational demands, different types of tastes, different types of identities that are built into them. And so I think, again, certainly coming out as a folklorist, it's a fascinating development to me. But if I wanted to play cultural critic, I could point out that, like with vodka, lots of those things that people are calling gins today have no resemblance to the historical taste of gin, to the historical traditions of gin, and really are largely commercial products that that are distinguishing from. In a saturated market, they are products that have to distinguish themselves from one another, and so they do so not through, say, long labor, long tradition, but by having something faddishly different about them from there. And it's not a criticism, and it's not a criticism of people who enjoy those. It's just a recognition that, wow, that really syncs with what you would think of as the capitalist culture of our day, the immediacy of the internet, and even the way, that there is a kind of youth culture organized by rebellion against, as is always the case, but against older generations in their taste. So that definitely links up to me, and I think that's fascinating.
So the second question I got to ask him is, do you think there's a story or set of stories that are not circulating in popular culture that should be regarding gin?
Well, when it comes to gin, and at least the audience that I am thinking of here, my dear friends at Assumption College, here's the thing. So if you jump on the pike, head west, pick up 84, and drive about an hour, right, just about an hour from Assumption College, you would be in the area of Connecticut of East Windsor and Enfield. And believe it or not, if you were in the United States in the, actually, quite frankly, through most of the 1800s, even into the very early 1900s, or for that matter, if you were in any place of the world, you would probably want to get access to the gins that were made in those three towns. It's a remarkable story that most people in New England do not know. And again, it's not a story in the sense of a fantastical, you know, hero tale. It's not a folkloric legend or something. This is a real, genuine thing. But to me, it's so fascinating. Not just because this is my beloved New England. Not just because, you know, as someone who lives in Connecticut, I'm deeply invested in the history of the Connecticut River Valley. But as a folklorist, it's fascinating to me how it is that this tiny part of Connecticut became internationally renowned in the 1800s, so much so that it was regarded, the gins of that area were regarded to be some of the finest gins of the world, on par with what was being produced in the Low Countries, in the Netherlands and in Belgium, and the gins, the Genevers, and the gins that were being produced in lots of parts of England. How is it possible that that happened? It's a fascinating piece of the, you know, of which New Englanders can certainly be proud from there. And lots of reasons for it. I mean, in some ways, again, people kind of forget that New England was almost not New England. New England could have been, right, the New Netherlands. The Dutch attempted to colonize the area. They seized the area of Manhattan, right? That was eventually wrestled from them. But the Dutch and the English were, although they worked together very often, right? Again, the English discovered Genever that became gin because of their alliances with the Dutch in the early 1600s. Well, by the later 1600s, they were competitors for colonization of the entire world. And part of that colonization took place on the soil of what we would think of as New England. So the Dutch were hitting the Connecticut River. They were already sailing up the Connecticut River in 1614. They were claiming that land. The Dutch East India Company, right, of course, was competing with English, you know, forces. And so it's an interesting thing, is right during that period that we would think of, right, as the same period as the 30 Years' War, when the English and the Dutch were allies, they were also competing over here to establish some type of dominance. And so when you think of some of the towns, right, at the mouth of the Connecticut River is Old Saybrook, founded in the 1630s by the English to stop the Dutch from effectively being able to get up the Connecticut River and to be able to, you know, to colonize the area. The history of, unfortunately, the genocide of indigenous people is tied in many ways to, in southern New England, is tied to the Pequot allying with the Dutch for fur, and then the English allying with the Mohegan to defeat the Pequot and to push the Dutch out. So lots of fascinating things are going on here. When I was the consulting folklorist at the Connecticut River Museum, I'd often do lectures, and I would start these lectures by asking people to take a sip of Genever to note for them that this would have been the first drink, the first taste of alcohol on the Connecticut River. It would have been the taste of Genever. Now, of course, brandy came with them and beer and so on, right? But that Dutch exploration of Connecticut and the area of the Connecticut River Valley. Well, one of the reasons that they were so interested in the area is the rye that could be grown here, the types of grains that would grow well in that part of the Connecticut River Valley that the Dutch wanted included places where rye would grow extremely well. Wheat, not so much. Barley, not so much, but rye could grow very well, and rye makes a great type of Genever or gin. And that's indeed what happened, is the English noticed the same. And so when the English won out, when they took over and won out and grabbed that area and founded the towns of Windsor and subsequently, you know, Enfield and et cetera, they began to produce gins in this area. And by the 1800s, the early 1800s, you had historians claiming that particularly East Windsor, right? But certainly that triangle of towns of Windsor, East Windsor, and Enfield. Those are on both sides of the Connecticut River, by the way, and closer to the border of in Connecticut. They're closer to the border of Massachusetts than they are to the shoreline, right? All things relative in a small state like Connecticut. But in the early 1800s, historians were claiming that that area would soon be known as the Scheidam of New England, the Scheidam of Connecticut, the Scheidam of the New World. Scheidam, of course, being the major place in the Netherlands, even more important than Amsterdam at the time, of being the place that made the best jenevers and the best gins. And so the history, believe it or not, the history of gin does come through New England, does come through Connecticut and through those areas. I live in Lyme, Connecticut, so I drive up, I have a two-hour commute to Amherst, and I drive up, basically following the Connecticut River, and I'll pass a sign every time I do for Warehouse Point in East Windsor. And that is where, at Warehouse Point, this phenomenal rye gins were made through much of the 1800s, and again, that were internationally renowned and rivaled, in terms of the market, anything that you could find in England, anything that you could find in the, in the Enever making countries from there. So what happened? Well, what happened is this gin that is, again, effectively a rye gin. Today you can get rye gins, right? And they have a different flavor than, say, wheat gins and or the barley-based Enevers, right? But that rye gin that was incredibly popular, what happened? Well, one thing that happened is fads, right? Is that people got tired of drinking Connecticut rye gins. And what was all the rage got eventually bumped for what? Well, it got bumped for what England was doing. England started to really master and develop the drier gin. A rye gin, right, tends to be a little bit sweeter. And when I say sweeter here, I mean the way that whiskey is sweet. It's not sweet. It's not a sweet drink. But it has more flavors, more sugary flavors to it than what we think of as dryness, right? And so that the rye gin is distinct from, say, the London or Plymouth dry gins. Rye is different from dry in that, while both are emphasizing Genever, the rye gin has a little bit more of a, again, more of a whiskey flavor to it, more of a of what we think of as a kind of sugared taste versus that dryness that you find in the quintessential, say, London dry from there. And that's what happened, is that people stopped. Eventually, they wanted a new fad. They wanted a new drink, not unlike what happens today, how we get to, say, the American Western gins. That people's taste changed. The new generation wanted something else, and rye gin got bumped for the rise of English gins, right? And so what was once the most popular gin in the world, the Connecticut rye gins, gave way to the dominance, what became the ultimate dominant taste of the British gins. Now, there was a switchover then, right? And so then, of course, the companies in Connecticut tried to compete, tried to make those types of gins, and were very successful at it. They made Old Tom gins that were very much on par with what you'd find in England. They made the gins. They started making those dry gins. But then something else happened. The temperance movement, and eventually prohibition, all right? And so the rise of, and Connecticut was, like lots of places, Connecticut was a hotbed for it. And so the first hit was that people stopped wanting, particularly like the people in New York, stopped wanting Connecticut rye, and they wanted British dry gins. And then temperance really kicked in, leading to prohibition, and effectively ended any production, any distillery production at all. And so lots of people today who live in New England would have no idea that place in Connecticut and that part of our beloved Southern New England was, again, had an international role, was internationally renowned for almost a century. And I hope in sharing that, maybe we rekindle that kind of interest and rekindle the interest of the role that New England had to play in the development in the global market and the global culture of gins and Genevers and arguably of alcohol in general.
So I really love what Steve had to say about demanding immediate gratification, especially in regards to social media. That's something that we've become so used to. And we get so used to getting what we want specifically and when we want it that we often forget that those before us had to work very hard to get it that way. We decide that we want something a certain way, and we leave behind the work that actually went into getting it that specific way. That at one point, that one thing was considered perfect, now is no longer good enough. And gin is a great example of that. Gin had that one juniper flavor that was very idealistic for it, and that's what it was known for. But now that we want it to have all these botanical smells and flavors and looks, it's no longer what it used to be. And that's not good enough for a lot of people anymore. Not that that's a bad thing, it's just we really do forget that history. And I really wanted to ask Steve about the stories that are not currently circulating that should be, because I truly believe that we can have a much greater appreciation for these things, like alcohol specifically, if we know its deeper meaning and past. So whenever we drink alcohol, and gin specifically, we are drinking history, and in a way we are truly drinking the Dutch culture. And in the grander scheme of things, the history of gin and alcohol filters through to today. Especially in New England, there's so much culture and history here that by being a part of the history, we're being a part of the beginning of gin and what we know today. The gin that we know today, that is. Though this is airing in Massachusetts, Enfield and East Windsor, Connecticut are a short drive away and much closer to my home. And they hold so much meaning to the drink that we pass off as a gin and tonic or in a martini, a Vesper martini specifically, that's mostly made out of gin. Something that I think a lot of us look forward to on the weekend, I know I do, we pass off as an activity instead of a semi-considerable learning experience. Not that that's the one thing you should think about while drinking or while you're out with your friends, but I think it's important to consider alcohol as not only as a legal drug that we can just have fun with, but as a part of history, whether it's vodka, gin, or tequila, which tequila we will be talking about in the next episode. Not that we're drinking it in the wrong way, but I really think that we're thinking about it the wrong way. Like, for example, comparable to the way that we used to drink excess amounts of gin to take away from the symptoms of illness back X amount of years ago. This past year, throughout COVID, we drank alcohol in a similar way, and it was to take away from the pain of reality. As I said, it can be more than just a legal drug, but instead a bridge between who we used to be and who we are, and how culture has shaped both similarities and differences of the human experience. So if you're not a gin drinker, don't forget there's numerous different flavors, smells, scents, colors of gin that you can always try out. If London dry gin isn't your type or your favorite, then you can always try out botanical, a Hendrix, anything really. But like I said, our next episode is going to be on tequila, and it's really going to bridge across the importance of culture and history that we've been forgetting all of this time. So thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.
Hi, this is Jackie Smith. You're listening to WCUW Worcester 91.3 FM on the web at wcuw.org.